Hello and welcome to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name is Andrew Dalbo. I'll be here with Josh and Henry discussing all the good and bad about Arsenal Football Club. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to Pain in the Arsenal podcast episode 14. My name is Andrew Dalzell. I'm here with Josh Zippy, as always. Henry is dealing with some exams at the moment, but he will be with us hopefully in the next week to 2 weeks. It will be certainly interesting to see what he thinks on what's been going on in this January transfer window. Josh, how are you doing?
Doing well. Can't complain. Anytime Arsenal wins, it seems like everything else is just fine.
Yes. It certainly puts a positive filter on everything, doesn't it?
Yes.
Speaking of the win, it was a Saturday 3 o'clock game, which threw me off my rhythm massively because Arsenal never play Saturday 3 o'clock games at the moment. It felt, I think, because of the Europa League, which means they play Thursday night and then they have to play Sunday, and then because it was the festive period, they never played Saturday afternoon. It was really, really weird. So anyway, that's just me being a bit odd. So it was a Saturday 3 o'clock game. It was at the Emirates, and within 13 minutes, Arsenal were 3 goals to the good, and the game was over. Really, is that how you saw it?
Yeah, which is always exciting, but then you know that the next like hour is going to be pretty boring because Arsenal's just not a team that wants to pile it on. They want to get their goals and then be happy with it. Which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Obviously, as fans, we'd rather see 8 or 9, but you know, if it's between that and risking injury, risking being exhausted, then they did the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, Wenger even made early substitutions, which, I mean, he seems to make them earlier when Arsenal are in the lead than when they're behind.
which seems a bit counterintuitive.
Yes.
But that's all right.
Yes. Well, I mean, much of what Wenger does is completely counterintuitive. So I guess in that way, it follows a lot of intuition, doesn't it? I guess the most important thing to speak on first was the formation change. Arsenal played, I would describe it as a 4-3-3 with Ozil and Iwobi flanking Lacazette and then Wilshere and Xhaka in these kind of, Pep Guardiola calls them kind of false number eights, where you have two of them flanking an anchor midfielder. And that's probably the best way to describe them. They're both kind of free roaming box-to-box roles, but they're not traditional attacking midfielders and they're not defensive midfielders either. They're kind of given the license to really do what they see and feel as is fit. Did you like the change to a back four? Obviously Arsenal have been playing back three recently, or did you think that it perhaps exposed a couple of vulnerabilities here and there?
No, I liked it. I always enjoy putting in more midfielders. Obviously I would have liked Ramsey in there instead of Elneny. Nothing against Elneny. Elneny did exactly what we always know he's going to do. He was perfectly fine, and that's just what he'll always be. He'll always be perfectly fine. He's not going to inspire the masses or do anything like that. But yeah, I like the two flanking the deep midfielder. I think it gives, you know, we always struggle with that pivot role. Well, if you've got two of them, your odds of succeeding in that pivot role are much higher than whenever you're just relying on one guy to do it. Without a reliable defensive midfielder behind him. And, you know, if anything, I think this is testament to that if we do put Wilshere and Ramsey next to Xhaka, granted, you do sacrifice a bit of defensive stability, but I do think you've got three players there that are responsible enough to never all three go forward and to always ensure that somebody is back, even if they're, you know, even if they all three require the freedom to succeed, which we're seeing more and more every time they take the pitch. I mean, these are three very similar players with very different skill sets, but they all enjoy doing the same things, and it's hard to fit all that into one starting 11. But I do think, like I said, that if you put those three together, which we still haven't seen, I don't think it's going to be as vulnerable as it seems on paper.
Yeah, I think that's very true. One thing that is, I mean, a lot of this kind of, there's been this recent upsurge in tactical breakdowns and people really getting a bit anal about, oh, well, this player's playing 5 yards further inside than this other player, so that means he's not a left back, he's a inside left back or something. And it's a bit ridiculous, really. I've always said there are pretty much only two formations in football. There's a back three and there's a back four. Because even the traditional 4-4-2, one of the strikers is always playing off the other one, so you can call it a 4 5-1, or you could call it a 4-2-3-1, or even like today, where it's a 4-3-3. It's just a 4-2-3-1 where the central attacker midfielder is dropped, you know, 5 yards, 10 yards deeper, and is more of a midfielder than a second striker. Really, there's not that much difference. But certainly, the having three natural centre midfielders rather than shifting Mesut Ozil into a deeper position, or you know, back in the old days, shifting Dennis Bergkamp back into a midfield position, rather than using a striker or an attacking player, using a natural midfielder in there, should in theory provide a bit more stability and security for a midfield that has been vulnerable and has been exploited on many different occasions in the past, especially on the counter-attack. I think the one thing that Elneny does provide is a little bit more athleticism, especially in contrast to Xhaka. If Xhaka was to play in the deeper role against the counter-attack, he could get exploited, whereas Elneny has a little bit more pace and a little bit more athleticism to be able to cover the ground. But I do agree, it's a midfield that offers a nice balance, which is something that Arsenal really have been a very unbalanced team for quite a long time, to be honest.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, we went through years and years and years of 4-2-3-1 every single match, and it was a rigid 4-2-3-1. There wasn't a lot of interchanging, and I mean, you always talk about people always talk about Arsene Wenger's inability to switch things up, and I'd agree he is very stubborn, but I do appreciate how willing he has been to sort of take his formations on the fly based on who he has, and not trying to shoehorn people where they don't belong. It's good to see. It's good to see that he's experimenting with new things. Finally, after 21 years, he's trying new things. But you know, it gives me a lot of confidence going forward that whatever signings we get, he will find the best way to use him. And there are still going to be exceptions, like Ainsley Maitland-Niles, if he's really using him properly. But you know, but with the resources that he has, he's been molding that formation. It's almost a different formation every time. Even whenever it's a four at the back, you know, the midfield is shaped differently. If it's a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1, it shows a lot of adjustment on his part. Yeah. And I think he deserves credit for that.
Yep. No, I agree completely. And it's still weird for me that Arsenal have these two systems and they're using them side by side. And it's almost as if Wenger's adapting to his opposition, which, you know, it's mind-blowing, really. I've never
That's
seen
insane.
Him do this.
I didn't know he could do that.
No, neither did I. It's quite incredible. I know in, might be in Tony Adams' book, there's a book of a player who used to play in the kind of the very early Wenger years and played at Arsenal before then. He was talking about how Wenger basically would very rarely focus on the opposition, and he'd basically just say, if we play as well as we can and we play to our ability, then they should be the ones adapting to us, not the other way around. And that's been a philosophy that he's always held, which does have some accuracy and does have some credence. But I think as the level in the Premier League has improved, especially you're looking at the other teams in the top six, as they've got better, you have to be a bit more pragmatic in your approach and say, well, actually, we're going to adapt to what the opposition can do and we're going to play differently. And to Wenger's credit, he is slowly but surely coming around to this idea of being adaptable to the opposition that he's facing. Did you like specifically the return of Monreal and Koscielny to the back four? I know, obviously, Monreal playing at left back rather than at centre half.
Yeah, I mean, I was dubious at first because I have been so high on Callum Chambers. I think he's getting a bad rap whenever he's actually been pretty quality. But I mean, this was always going to be coming. I mean, he's always going to trust our veteran defenders, and it worked out. I mean, this didn't look like the Koscielny that I've been sort of dreading this season. He looked like he was back in good form and good shape. Hopefully, he wasn't in the pain that he apparently is always in. And I mean, obviously, we have to be thrilled with what Monreal did because he came on for 30 minutes, he got two assists and a goal, and then he took off. So yeah, I mean, it brings about an interesting situation at left back because of all the options that we have, and you know, that's something to watch going forward. How Arsene Wenger handles having so many options at one specific position.
Yeah, because this was obviously the first game that Kolasinac was available for selection as well, and he did come on later in the game, but he came on after Maitland-Niles had already come on for Monreal, and Wenger, he used to do this with Kieran Gibbs a lot, didn't he, where if Arsenal were winning, he'd bring on Kieran Gibbs as a left winger rather than a left back and play two left backs down the left side. He did the same thing here when he brought Kolasinac on. I do think it's interesting that even a week, 2 weeks ago, Arsenal only had one left back in Maitland-Niles, and now suddenly they've got three if they commit to a back four for the rest of the year. And it's a position of relative strength, I think. Both Monreal and Kolasinac are extremely experienced and established players, particularly Monreal. And I think Maitland-Niles is a very talented, if perhaps a little inconsistent, but he's certainly got the natural ability to develop into a top player. It will be very interesting to see how Wenger continues to rotate his options moving forward.
I do in particular, and a lot of people do, talk about how there's not enough competition for places. And I caught myself griping that Kolasinac is being unfairly sort of shafted. And I was like, well, that's kind of hypocritical because we finally have competition. And for, you know, I think one thing Wenger has avoided is having more than one, I guess you could say, starting options at positions where there can only be one. Like left back, it feels like he's really avoided having more than one guy there because it provides selection problems. But, I mean, you see what Spurs are doing with it. They've got two quality left backs, two quality right backs, and they're just rotating and keeping it fresh. And for the most part, it's working out for them. I mean, those are four left backs that are all sort of on equal footing. And it'd be interesting to see if we got another quality right back, which I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But for the time being, it's neat because, you know, whenever you pit two guys against each other and the most informed person comes out on top, then these two players keep getting better. I mean, at least that's the idea. That's what's supposed to happen in a perfect world, which, as we know, isn't always the case. But no, it'll be interesting to see how Kolasinac reacts. I think that he'd probably be out there against Chelsea. We'll talk about that more later, but it'll be interesting to see how he reacts to this whole, he's actually got an obstacle now.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that I think would be interesting is if Arsenal continue with a back four, classifying Monreal as a fullback and not a centre-half, then I wonder if, like you were saying, of buying a right-back, well, I wonder if Wenger says, well, why don't we play Maitland-Niles at right-back? And, you know, because obviously he's right-footed and would be more natural on that side. The point
that would make way too much sense for Arsene Wenger.
Yes, unfortunately you're right there. The point on Spurs is an interesting one because both in Pochettino and Wenger's system, there's a great demand, physical demand, asked of their fullbacks. They're asked to push high up the picks, to make those overlapping runs. Quite often the wingers aren't traditional wingers. They're allowed to drift inside. And if the fullbacks aren't spreading the pitch wide, then the team's attack can become very narrow and very predictable. Because of that, physically they are exerting themselves quite at quite a high level, game in and game out. So asking them to play two games a week, three games a week, very regular football can be quite demanding. So I think that's why Pochettino has always valued having four quality fullbacks at both left back and or two at left back and two at right back. I think Wenger may be, or should be, and hopefully it is, beginning to think the same type of thing with Arsenal. Certainly Monreal and Kolasinac are two very good left-backs, and Bellerin, and if he does shift Maitland-Niles over or buys another one, then that's two decent right-backs as well. And I think in the past he has very much had a starter and a reserve. You're right, in terms of the competition, it's always been, well, this guy's my number one and this guy's my number two, and if a number one gets injured, then I'm happy to start him. But otherwise, he's going to play in the cup games, and that's it. Let's roll it forward a little bit. Do you think that Mohamed Elneny could potentially unseat Granit Xhaka as the holding centre midfielder? Or do you think this was a Aaron Ramsey's ill when I want to get a third centre midfielder in there, and it's going to be Elneny?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to unseat anyone.
No, neither do I.
Xhaka's going to move back there. If they do stick with this formation, Xhaka's going to be the deep midfielder, which is almost kind of a shame because, I mean, for me, somebody who will always praise Granit Xhaka, even when I shouldn't, against Crystal Palace, he was given a hell of a lot more freedom to do what he wants, and I think it really paid off. I always look at how they combine with Wilshere, Ozil, these guys that do the clever flicks and the quick passes, and he fit right in with that. Obviously, he wasn't as quick. This was kind of his first time being in such an attack-heavy role. But, I mean, it raises questions for going forward, because if you do play him in this deep position, you're kind of saying, well, I see what he can do, but he's not going to do that. He's going to do something else. And I don't know, for me, it sort of unlocked this capability that we haven't seen that much. I mean, we've been relying on him to sit deep, to sort of spread the pitch with his long passing, but when you put him in those forward positions, yeah, he's not fast, he's not agile or anything, but he's really intelligent when he gets in those forward positions.
Yep.
And there's a hell of a lot less risk to his passing up there than there is in the middle of the pitch whenever he's sitting deep. So, again, talking about things to watch going forward, I'm wondering if he'll be able to play that more box-to-box role, because I think even when he signed, Arsene Wenger said, well, he's a box-to-box midfielder. And we kind of just dismiss that as he's too slow to be a box-to-box midfielder. But I think it really worked out. It's just the question now is, you've got three guys that want to play that role, like I pointed out earlier, and how do you consolidate that? And I think the answer is Xhaka is going to slide back into the deeper role.
Yeah, which it isn't necessarily Xhaka's fault, is it, that he's been played out of position? It does remind me a little bit of Arteta, where Arteta was continually played as the holding midfielder, and it was just a ridiculous decision because he couldn't tackle anybody. And Granit Xhaka has different flaws to Arteta, but he does have some key flaws that in the defensive midfield role, they are exposed significantly more than they are if he's playing in a box-to-box role, where his passing is a little bit more protected, I guess. If he gives the ball away, he's not exposing his defence as much, and his immobility isn't as vulnerable to the counter-attack when he's in a slightly more advanced position. Certainly, it will be interesting, and we'll touch on this later in the programme, when Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang arrive, whether Xhaka will be able to continue playing in a more advanced role or not. That is a question that Wenger will have to answer and will answer as the season unfolds. Let's just look at a few more positives from the game on Saturday, because there were lots of positives to be taken. It was a 4-1 win. It was a good performance. There was 20 minutes in the first half, the latter half of the first half, where Arsenal played some really wonderful football. Obviously, the fourth goal itself was brilliant. I know Mesut Ozil touched the ball six times in that build-up, picking it up off Nene and playing 1-2s with Iwobi and Wilshere and then flicking it into Lacazette's path. So it was a really lovely goal, and it was indicative of some of the kind of confident, free-flowing, sweeping moves that Arsenal put together. What were your, other than the midfield change and stuff like that, what were your other positives that you would draw from the game, Josh?
I mean, obviously that Lacazette ended his goal drought. It stretched to 8 matches, and I looked back into when he's had a worse goal drought to sort of see how he reacted to it. And he hasn't had a goal. The worst goal drought he had was in 2013. He was just 22 years old, and he went 9 games without a goal. But he ended up finishing off on a tear. And we kind of saw that again in 2015, 2016. It was kind of a down year for him at the start. He never went on a drought. He just wasn't scoring as many. But then it seems like every time he hits a negative spot, he comes back even stronger. So that's something I'm really excited to see. I do think that this new burst of confidence, playing with Ozil, playing with hopefully Mkhitaryan soon, I think that we're not going to see Lacazette hit that low again. And I say that, usually I'd be like, oh, you shouldn't say that, that's bad luck. But I really do, I don't think that I have any, we have anything to worry about with him relapsing into another drought, because I mean, he's too good of a striker, and we have too many creative options. And he's just never had something like that happen before. I mean, this is only his second goal drought of a career that's actually pretty lengthy for how... I mean, he's only 26, but he's had 5 good years at the top, and this has only happened one other time. And you know, that's definitely something positive to pull away from that.
Yeah, and I don't know if he played that much better. I thought he was better, but I don't think he was. It wasn't like he played phenomenally well and had been playing, you know, disastrously over the last few games. But there was an air of confidence about his play, especially after he got the goal. Like, you saw the kind of intensity and the passion of his celebration. He was clearly putting himself under pressure to score, and there was a big release after he got that goal. So certainly from a mental aspect as much as anything, there was a growing confidence from himself, a growing self-belief in his own ability to go and continually score goals. And we have to remember, this is a new league, a new team, a new country. These are new teammates. He's playing against new opposition, and there must have been some aspect of self-doubt that, you know, he must have been saying, can I actually do this in a league that is better than what I've ever played in before?
Well, plus you also have to remember, I mean, he was in a goal drought, but Lukaku and Morata, both new teams, were also both in a struggling, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of always works out that way, where you go to the new team, you've got a few months where opposing teams haven't seen you, so you have a lot more success, and then they start to catch on to what you do. I mean, when Alexis Sanchez first got here, he always did that dribble down, cut inside, score. It worked every time, but then mm-hmm. teams started to figure it out, and he had to readjust, and he did. And I think Lacazette's now in that readjustment period of figuring out how he can overcome the defenses that are starting to key in on what he does.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's not even like he played that much better. I mean, the things that he was doing outside of the goal were the same kind of things. I mean, he was still connecting really well. He was making good runs. He was finding space. So that's a huge positive to take away, is whenever he scores, whenever he doesn't, whenever he has confidence, whenever he doesn't, he still is contributing in the same ways outside of goal scoring.
Yeah, one thing to me that was really interesting was that his pass success rate was actually 86%, which for centre forward is extremely high. So it's the same as Mesut Ozil, higher than Iwobi and Xhaka and Wilshere. So that was, I mean, we've seen games even in the last few weeks where him and Sanchez have had pass success rates of in the 60s and 70%. So up at 86% is really very high, and that, I think that showed his overall contribution to the team more than just a goal, but obviously the goal is the thing that will give him the confidence and hopefully the attitude to now kick on and begin to put a few good performances together, hopefully starting on Wednesday against Chelsea. Another player who I think played well, who has come into come under some flack in recent weeks, is Alex Iwobi. I actually thought he played very well against Chelsea in the Carabao Cup in the first semi-final, and I think he played well again here. Would you agree?
Yeah, and you know, he's probably the player I've been hardest on for months now, because I've just been so frustrated seeing him out there match after match looking ineffective. Mm-hmm. I disagree. I don't think he was good against Chelsea in the Carabao Cup, but that's okay. And yeah, I mean, whenever you're so critical of a player, inevitably you're going to try to pick out things that go wrong.
Yep.
But he was fantastic. I mean, obviously he wasn't perfect. Nobody's ever perfect. He had some slip-ups, but overall he was a great contributor to an attack that was really on fire there for a while, and he fit right into the middle of it, which is all you really need to see.
Yeah. He feels like a confidence player, doesn't he? We've seen him have these droughts of real kind of suffering, just a lack of self-belief, a lack of self-conviction, I guess, an element of doubting his own ability. And then we've seen these other periods where he's willing to take risks, and he's really direct in his dribbling, and he tries the risky passes and things like that, and that's when he's kind of he kind of feels it. I know in the pre-season he looked really good, he looked really sharp, and that's because he was playing with such an attacking intention, because he felt like he had the ability to go and change the game. So hopefully, if he can put another couple of good performances together, that confidence begins to seep back into his game. I know you want to talk about Granit Xhaka as well, so I'll give you the floor on the £35 million man.
Yeah, I mean, I've already been singing his praises quite a bit, but I do think that he gets a bad rap, and I think sometimes with Arsenal fans, you just kind of have to expect that a new player that isn't doing what they expected him to do is always going to get a bad rap, and there's just nothing he can do about it. That said, not that many people have been talking about what he did against Crystal Palace, and you know, one thing I haven't highlighted yet is his corner delivery was fantastic. I mean, it led to two goals, and he's had some bad corners this year. I don't know what changed, but all of a sudden, making it over the first line of defenders was easy. He was finding exactly who he needed to find. It seemed like every time I couldn't wait for more corners. And for Arsenal, I usually dread corners because it feels like the end of an attack and the potential counterattack for the other team. But, I mean, he nailed it. And I have no idea, any speculation what that would come down to. But other than that, you know, whenever you don't rely on a player who's not a defensive player to play defense, it's amazing what can happen, because I feel like it sort of freed him up, and it was the same with Aaron Ramsey. Whenever we stuck him at right wing, you know, it kind of plays on a guy's head when he's in a position that he's not familiar with, where he has responsibilities that he's not used to doing. It doesn't allow them to be who they need to be, and it looked like, I mean, we saw Arsene Wenger sort of catered this formation and it to what Ramsey needed, and it worked out. Ramsey came back to his best self. And I wonder now if he's willing to do the same for Granit Xhaka, or if he's going to keep insisting that he's a defensive midfielder, which we all know he's not. Mm. I mean, he's making subtle improvements. I think his tackling has gotten better. His discipline has, definitely. But he's never going to be a defensive midfielder. He's not going to be a wrecker. And I worry. I don't know if worry is the right word. I'm concerned that that's been the plan with him, is to try to make him a defensive midfielder with playmaking upside. But I think he needs to be the opposite. I think he needs to be a playmaking midfielder with defensive upside. And, you know, like I was talking about earlier, he doesn't have the speed or the agility, but he does do a good job of shielding the ball from challenges. And I saw that more against Crystal Palace, where he was shielding it while on the run. And it looks kind of awkward at times, but most of the time it works out, where if somebody is coming at him, whether from whatever position, he's able to put himself in between that player and the ball, which, you know, anytime we can preserve possession is a good thing, since we've had so much problem losing it.
He certainly uses his frame well.
Yeah, he does,
because he is a big player, but there are other big players who don't use it to the best of their ability, whereas he does use his size very well in the middle of the park.
And he did have a Mesut Ozil moment where he was in the box in front of goal and he should have just had a whack at it. Instead, he crossed it in and
Are you telling me Xhaka chose not to shoot?
Exactly. Yeah, wow. It was the closest he's been to goal all year and he chose not to shoot. I don't get what it was. I think it was kind of an awkward angle for his left foot. But, I mean, I don't know. With the strength of his foot, just you'll probably take the goalie into the goal with it. So just have a whack.
Yeah, certainly Xhaka deciding not to shoot is a little bit of a shock. I agree with everything you said, and certainly a lot of my criticisms of Xhaka aren't necessarily on Xhaka. They're more of an indictment of Wenger and Wenger's use of Xhaka. Do you think the problem with Xhaka is that he's not who Arsenal need, in the sense that I think personally that Jack Wilshere and Aaron Ramsey are both better box-to-box midfielders than Granit Xhaka is.
Yeah, they are.
And therefore, do you not think that, let's say, if Arsenal could ship off Xhaka for 20 million and replace him with a proper defensive midfielder, Nemanja Matic or an N'Golo Kante, like a proper defensive midfielder, not a makeshift defensive midfielder, do you not think that would be better for this Arsenal team? Or do you think that Xhaka still has a role to play?
You're making this unpleasant for me to have to think about these things.
I'm pushing you hard on this.
I mean, thinking 100% practically, I hate to say this, but yeah, it makes more sense to have a legitimate defensive midfielder rather than Xhaka. But I don't want to say that until I see how having Wilshere, Ramsey, and Xhaka in the same midfield could work. Because I'm convinced that can work, and I'm convinced that that's what Wenger wanted. Because he's been so outspoken about how little he wants a midfielder that can only play defense. Mm. And I don't know. I mean, I still think that, that Xhaka's abilities are up there with he's definitely an Arsenal quality player, just not the qualities we expected him to have. And like you said, that's not his fault. That's I wouldn't even say it's Arsene Wenger's fault necessarily. I think the expectations were just too high for him, too high in the wrong areas.
Yeah.
We've seen plenty of quality from him. Just, I mean, whenever he first came over, he was expected to be Patrick Vieira. He's nothing like Patrick Vieira. No. The only thing he can do, pass, maybe his intensity is kind of up there. I love seeing him get in
in the faces of the... Wilshere got involved as well.
I know, that was the best. Yeah. And there's a picture of it, which I've been overusing on our articles. It's just, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, so let me take back what I said. I don't think that we should ship him off. Not until we see how he can do with Ramsey and Wilshere in the same midfield.
Right. Obviously, in the same summer that Arsenal signed Xhaka, Chelsea signed Kante, and
why do you have to point that out?
And this one will be more controversial. And Spurs signed Wanyama. Now. Personally, I would rather have either of those players than Granit Xhaka. Not necessarily because I think they're better players than Granit Xhaka, although I think Kante is, but because I think they're different players to Granit Xhaka. And the difference is key, because what they offer is a complement to what Arsenal already have, where I think Xhaka only brings similar talents, I guess, to what the midfield already has in Ramsey and Wiltshire and Cazorla if he comes back and those kind of players. Would you go as far as Wanyama, or
actually before Spurs got Wanyama, I really wanted him. I mean, I remember when I'll never forget the one game where Mesut Ozil was covered by Wanyama, and Wanyama was on him like a backpack. He just would not let him go, and it completely shut Ozil down.
And I think you've noticed the difference with Spurs this year, because Wanyama's been injured for lots of the season, and Moussa Dembélé has also been struggling with injury and has not been at his best. The absence of those two has been really really critical for their midfield.
I do think I mean it's clear what Arsene Wenger is going for with Xhaka. I think he's willing to sacrifice the defense and the stability to capitalize on his over-the-top passing, which when you look at the striker he got in Lacazette, it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, no, it does make sense.
These over-the-top balls are supposed to...
And even last season, he dropped Giroud for Sanchez, a more mobile center forward.
Yeah. I never understood why he didn't play Giroud and Xhaka together more, because you think, you know, you got Xhaka to loft it forward, Giroud to knock it down.
Big man, little man.
Yeah, exactly. And then you just got to surround him with, I don't know, that's going down a tangent that I don't need to go down.
Josh's two favorite players in Granit Xhaka and Olivier Giroud.
I don't know. I obviously N'Golo Kante is kind of in a league of his own. To say that you wouldn't prefer him to just about anybody else is...
I mean that is an extreme example of...
Maybe I'm biased, but I would still take Xhaka over Wanyama because of what he can provide. I mean, we're an attacking side. I don't think that adding a little bit of defense in the midfield would make that much of a difference, because we do have midfielders like Wilshere and Ramsey who will track back and who will do their share of man marking, even if it doesn't work every time. So I don't know. Maybe I'm biased, but I'd still take Xhaka.
Hmm. I mean, certainly my issues with Xhaka aren't really with Xhaka. They're with the use of him and the fact that he's just the wrong guy at the wrong place in the wrong position. That's not his fault. It's just the type of player that he is. Is not quite suited to what I would have wanted Arsenal to go and sign.
I remember still one of the best lines I think I've ever heard is when Arsene Wenger was convincing Granit Xhaka to come to Arsenal. He said, come to Arsenal because it'll be paradise for you.
Yeah.
Like, which part of this is paradise? You're out of position. You're criticized. He's on a Giroud level of scapegoating, like early Giroud days.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's not protected by a defensive midfielder.
No, he's completely exposed on his own. I do feel sorry for him, where I mean, I love Aaron Ramsey, and I think he's a better player than Xhaka, but there have been moments where positionally Ramsey's just completely deserted him, and Xhaka's been all on his own and has looked a lot worse because nobody's with him.
He keeps making these promises to players. Like, they're saying that now Wenger has promised Aubameyang more world-class signings in the summer. Like, when are people going to catch on that these promises aren't always what you expect them to be?
No.
I don't know.
No, Wenger says a lot that isn't true. He said that Alexis Sanchez will be done in, 48 hours, did he say?
Yeah. He said that twice, about a week apart.
He said it once, and then at the end of that 48 hours, he said, no, next 48 hours. And that was about 2 weeks ago, something like that. Absolutely incredible. Yes.
And now apparently it's just because the team photographer is not with the team, so they can't announce it.
Oh, Wenger and his ways. He is outstanding. Is there anything else you want to touch on from the Palace game?
Nah. I mean, it was such a positive game that I don't want to dwell on the negatives. I mean, if we do want to glance over them really quick, I thought Ainsley Maitland-Niles, ever since Maitland-Niles gave the ball away at Bournemouth to Jordan, I'm going to say his last name wrong. It's either Ibe or Ibe. I don't know how to say it.
Over here, we correctly say it as Ibe.
Okay, then I'll call him Jordan Ibe since it's correct. It was just one of the most shocking passes I've ever seen. And ever since that moment, it's like his confidence is just gone. You can trace it to that exact moment. But, you know, he's young. And I don't know why he wasn't used in central midfield. But anyways. And you know, it was cool to see Reece Nelson. He did look very overexcited. But that's fine. You know, hopefully, I'm thinking that his days at right wing back might be over.
Especially if the formation changes.
Yeah, with Walcott gone, I think we'll see a lot more of him in attacking roles, which is the goal. So, not many negatives to talk about. It was a great game.
No, I think one thing to note is the bench was very, very weak. Ramsey was ill. Welbeck was surprisingly injured. And then, in terms of the attacking options, you basically had Iwobi and Ozil, who just returned and very out of form, Lacazette. And that was it, really. On the bench, the two attackers that Wenger had were Nketiah and Nelson. So, which you know, Arsenal with 3-0 up after 13 minutes, it doesn't really matter. But had the game gone differently and it had been 0-0 after an hour, something like that, really, Wenger didn't really have many options on the bench to try and change that game. Again, Arsenal is still dealing with lots of injuries. Giroud, Welbeck's out. Ramsey was obviously injured. Absent with the flu, sorry. And there is an anticipation that signings will come, but certainly it is something to be noted that a bench that has looked really strong all year, there have been moments when Theo Walcott hasn't been able to make the bench. So it's been a strong, strong squad, especially in attacking areas, looked a little bit flimsy on Saturday. Just one final thing to note there. Right, let's take a short break where we will return and we will discuss the ongoing transfers of Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, as we have referenced earlier in the programme, and we will also look at how they may fit in this Arsenal team. It is certainly a much more positive and joyful experience than it has been in recent weeks, so we will see you on the other side. Hello and welcome back to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. Me and Josh are here as always, and we are going to talk about the wonderful world of the transfer window because, and I can't quite believe I'm going to say this, Arsenal are signing players. And not only are they signing players, they're signing good players, like proper people, like not 18-year-old Brazilians who no one's heard of. They're signing, not a 20-year-old Greek defender. They're signing proper players. It's incredible.
Well, you're getting a bit ahead of yourself, but that's okay.
Yes. They haven't actually signed them yet, but, you know, we never know. Do you think... I'm, of course, talking about Henrik Mkhitaryan and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Do you think the two will happen?
Yeah. obviously we've fallen into this trap before, but I think with Mislintat there, with Arsene Wenger, I do believe he's in a new mentality. And, you know, it's not even him that's doing these negotiations. It's Gazidis is over there doing the negotiations, which I think is the most promising thing of this whole ordeal, because Arsene Wenger, you know, I'll always think to that one summer where he was reffing a charity event in Italy and therefore couldn't focus on signing a replacement striker, which we desperately needed.
Yeah, and, it was on transfer deadline.
Yeah, he's out there with you know, all these celebrities.
Wasn't he with the Pope or something?
Yeah, so he was getting christened or something. I don't know. It was ridiculous. And meanwhile, we've got Giroud and nobody else.
That might be the most Arsenal transfer window thing in the world. It's just incredible.
There was just no multitasking with him, and now there doesn't have to be, which is why I think that it is different from where it used to be. And I do think that we'll get both Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan.
Yes, I do as well. Obviously, Aubameyang's a bit more. There's more to be done. There's a fee still to be agreed for certain. It looks like it may involve Giroud. Do you think it will, or do you think it will be a straight cash deal?
I would rather it be a straight cash deal, because I think you wrote the article where talking about, is it really smart to give up such an easy plan B in Giroud?
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you have Lacazette and Aubameyang, I assume you're going to start them both. You still got to have somebody that can replace one or the other, and that's Giroud. And you know Giroud wants to be here. You know he's always going to give his all for the club. The only
Well, actually, you say he wants to be here. Do you actually think he does want to be
here?
Yeah. Or do you think in a World Cup year, not that he doesn't like Arsenal, but specifically in a World Cup year, he would rather go and get playing time somewhere?
I am still going to put faith that Giroud wants to be here, because he said over the summer that he still had work to do here. And
Yep. I mean, he is to blame for Ronald Koeman failing at Everton.
Exactly.
as Ronald Koeman went to great pain to point out that it was all Giroud's fault, because he was in the building and he chose to stay at Arsenal.
I mean, I think I pointed this out in an earlier podcast. I do, small part of me wants Giroud to leave, because I want him to be in the World Cup. And if him not playing prevents him from going to the World Cup with France, then I'd rather see him leave, because I think he deserves to play in the World Cup.
Wow.
And it's his last chance to do that.
Putting the player before the club.
Well, he's not even playing, so it's not like he's helping the club that much.
No, that's true.
Do
you think it will involve Giroud, or do you think he will stay?
I mean, they say that even if Giroud does go the other way, it's going to be two separate deals, and Giroud's going to be like on a loan until the summer, and then it'll be made permanent.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Which, you know, it's odd. I don't know why you wouldn't just include him in the deal if it's going to lower the cash needed to get Aubameyang. But I don't know. I mean, we always talk about how silly swap deals are, and now we've got two potential swap deals that actually might happen. Mm. I don't know. I don't think that Aubameyang is going to be won or lost based on Giroud's availability.
No, neither do I. And what feels amazing is that Arsenal are going to break their transfer record for the second time in 6 months. If they go and sign Aubameyang, certainly he'll be more than £47 million. The reported fee is €60 million, isn't it, is what Dortmund are allegedly demanding. Again, let's be honest, these numbers are guesses as much as anything else. No one really knows the price that are paid. And even after a transfer's been completed, often the fee's never really that accurate. The agent will obviously leak a report that's a lot higher, whereas the team who sold the player will also leak the maximum amount of money that they can get, and you know they'll include all the incentives and the added bonuses and everything like that, whereas the team that's buying them will be keen to make the price as low as possible. Really, no one really knows what the price will be. I think it will be in the probably £50 to £55 million mark range. Maybe if Giroud's involved, it might drop to, say, £35 million, £40 million, plus Giroud on a loan or Giroud on a permanent deal, something like that. I think if Giroud was allowed to leave on loan for 6 months, that would be ideal for Arsenal, because then they still are able to lower the price a little bit and they get to keep Giroud, at least in the long term. And given that they're not going to be playing Champions League football in the next 6 months, do they need more than 2.5 strikers if you count Welbeck as half a striker? Probably not. They could probably get away with having Aubameyang, Lacazette and Welbeck and not needing another player. But when they're in the Champions League, perhaps they need a third guy in there to help them rotate through the number of games.
I do wish that we would focus on dropping Welbeck over Giroud, just because Welbeck brings a lot of the same things Aubameyang does, just not in as much effectiveness, whereas Giroud is something completely different.
No, I agree in terms of the one position being centre midfield, but there is a difference in terms of Welbeck's versatility in that he can play out wide, whereas Giroud certainly cannot play out wide. And Wenger has always been a fan of players who have the ability to play in a number of positions. And I think Wenger really likes that about Welbeck and Iwobi as well, that they can play on either wing or they can play central. It is a big selling point for Welbeck to Wenger. One more question before we come on to the team shape. When do you think it will happen? Because as we noted in the previous part, Arsenal's bench is looking a little bit thin at the moment and they could kind of do with some reinforcements.
Yeah, I'd really had hoped that since he left Lacazette on for the full 90, I had this bizarre idea that Aubameyang would be ready for Chelsea, which obviously isn't going to happen because it's going to take much longer than that. I would hope that Aubameyang is here by next week, and if we're going to get him at all. I would hate to see it go all the way down to the end of the window, especially because if you know you're going to get the guy, just get the guy. I mean, if like £5 million is the difference, what's the point of negotiating that? Whenever you think of the games that you're missing, that you could have had him. Yeah, exactly. For Mkhitaryan, you have to believe that that's right around the corner. I mean, kind of like Alexis, it's like, oh, well, it could happen any minute. It's going to happen in 48 hours. 48 hours later, it'll be 24 hours. 24 hours later, it's like, oh, it's almost here. And it's got to be just around the corner.
Mourinho said at the weekend that it was, quote, so close. So,
well, plus, it is. Yeah, I mean, you hear Wenger saying you can't have Alexis at Man United without Mkhitaryan at Arsenal, and we've seen pictures of Alexis at United. So, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Mkhitaryan is ready for Chelsea on Wednesday. This whole taking it down to the wire thing drives me nuts. It's like Wenger knows he finally...
Every year.
It's like Wenger knows he has something that we all want, and he's just holding it there like, oh, when can I really get them?
Yeah, he's a bit of a masochist, really. He just likes to induce pain on the fans. He kind of sees, I wonder how foolish and naive they can be and how far I can push them. Let's talk about the main issue, really, because if Arsenal go and sign Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, as is looking relatively likely, they have four attackers in Lacazette, in Ozil, in Mkhitaryan and in Aubameyang, who are relatively similar, who play relatively similar positions, who don't necessarily fit directly into a starting 11, and really, who don't necessarily defend that much, I think it's fair to say. I know Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang come from a pressing system at Dortmund and they like to press high up the pitch, but in terms of tracking runners deep and being diligent and disciplined, they're not really those kind of players. Ozil definitely isn't, and Lacazette isn't really either. So, firstly, we'll look on personnel. What personnel do you think Wenger's going to play? But also, do you think the style will change a little bit? Do you think he's going to adopt a bit more of a high-energy, high-intensity game to suit the players that he's bringing in as well?
That's the big question. It is, for so many years, we've had it where the starting 11 is head and shoulders better than anyone that could challenge them for those positions. I mean, you think back to the start of the year, the closest thing we had to a challenger in midfield was Mohamed Elneny. The closest thing we had to a challenger for attack was Alex Iwobi. And none of them were ever going to challenge Ramsey, Xhaka, Ozil, Alexis. They were never going to challenge them. So, you know, you bring in two attackers in Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan, who both can be world class. I would say Aubameyang is world class, and Mkhitaryan, if he finds his form again, can get at least pretty close to that. And I mean, no matter how you spin it, unless you go off the wall in like a heavy attack formation, somebody's going to have to sit. And you know,
do you think it's possible to play all four? Do you not think that's gonna not gonna happen? Do you think it's not possible?
It's definitely possible. But then between Ramsey, Wilshere, Xhaka, you'd have to pick one to sit. And honestly, I don't know who of those Wenger would most lean towards sitting. My fear is that he would have to choose between Wilshere and Ramsey, since they are similar players.
Similar, yeah.
Unless you want to do the old Mighty Magyars of 1950, where you'd go with the 3-2-3-2 or the six-shooter attack, as I like to call it, and you just have this huge midfield attacking formation and just sacrifice the hell out of your defense. But, you know, we all know that's not going to happen. Of course, if it does, then nope. Then that would be exciting. But the most logical thing I can think of is that he's going to have to choose between Ramsey and Wilshere, because you don't bring in Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang and then not play them, especially in the Premier League. I mean, they're not here to play the Carabao Cup or the Europa League, which, you know, there's complications there for the Europa League, but they're here to play the Premier League. And you can't sit Lacazette, because same with him. He didn't come over here to play in these side competitions. Sure as hell can't sit Ozil, so they all four have to start. And it's just a matter of figuring out how you make that happen.
Yeah, I wonder. I certainly think they cannot be crowbarred into a back three based system, unless if you go with your mental 1950s, 1960s Hungarian.
The six shooter, it's great.
Yeah, because really, if you play back three and you've got your two wing backs, you've then only got five players to play in a team. Two of them need to be central midfielders at least. So then you've only got three attackers. It's going to be difficult to crowbar four attacking players into that team. So if he is going to play all four, it suggests to me that there's going to be a shift to a back four-based system. Now, whether that's a 4-3-3 and he only plays three of them, or plays Mkhitaryan or Ozil as one of the central midfielders and then Aubameyang, Lacazette and the other one as one of the attackers, I'm not sure. Whether it's a 4-1-4-1 even, and he plays two of Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang and Ozil wide, the other one in centre midfield, and then Lacazette on his own up front, something like that. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be very interesting. I think in terms of the versatility of the positions, Lacazette is probably the least versatile. I know Wenger has played him in the kind of in the 3-4-3. He kind of plays that inside left forward role, which isn't really a left wing role. People have been trying to say, oh, he's playing left wing. It's very different to left wing. You don't have to provide width. You're playing off the striker. You're a lot more centralised, and it's a lot easier for a centre forward to play that role. I think Aubameyang could play out wide if Wenger wanted him to. Now, would that be the best use of his skills? Probably not. But if you wanted to squeeze all four in, I think at some point Aubameyang has to play on either the left or the right.
I feel like this is a good chance for Arsene Wenger to confront his sudden deathly fear of having two strikers. He's just absolutely refused to play two strikers since a long time. I still don't understand why he never put Giroud and Lacazette out there together. He did, but he would push Lacazette further wide, and Giroud would be the only front man. I don't know why you can't have two strikers, and I don't know in this formation how you don't. Aubameyang can play wide. I can't imagine him giving up a team where he's playing central to come to Arsenal where he's not going to play central. Unless Arsene Wenger is keeping secrets, which isn't exactly a good tactic in this regard.
No, it wouldn't surprise me either, though. I do like the idea of Lacazette and Aubameyang playing together. One problem is they're both very similar players. They both want to run in behind, so you have that problem of are they taking up the same space as one another. The other issue that you might have is that if you're going to play wingers in that situation, then you probably have to play Mkhitaryan and Ozil as your two wingers in a kind of 4-4-2 type system, which is fine, apart from neither of them are really natural wingers. So now you've got two strikers who are very similar players, you've got two wingers who don't really want to play wide, and you've only got two central midfielders, it kind of doesn't really work.
So what's going to end up happening is he's going to have a back four, and then he's going to have...
A four centre midfielders too.
He's just going to have a 4-6 and just say, everybody have fun, just play well together, and we're going to do great. Because
He did say Wenger was asked after the Palace game, how are you going to fit Mkhitaryan and Ozil in the same team? And he says, well, they're good players, and he's going to play them.
Which comes off as a joke, but he's probably just being completely truthful there. that's mostly what he's been doing lately with our midfield, is just kind of see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, we've used the analogy before of he's like a chef and he kind of throws the ingredients into a bowl and mixes them around, whacks them in the oven and expects it to turn into a cake. And
sometimes it does, though. Really. Sometimes.
Well, yeah. I mean, sometimes he gets lucky, but, you know, 5 times out of 6, it's not quite going to work like that. You need a bit of plan. Need a bit of preparation, Wenger. Not really got any at the moment. I do wonder if if he chooses to play 3, because if you do play the 3-4-3, you could feasibly play all 4 in all 3 of the front 3 positions, other than Ozil and Mkhitaryan as the central striker. So you could play a front 3 of Ozil, Aubameyang and Lacazette, or Mkhitaryan, Lacazette and Ozil, or Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang and Lacazette, and so on. As long as you have one of Lacazette or Aubameyang as the central striker, I think all of the players could play either side of that in the two wide roles of the front three. So maybe he just plays like, I've got 4 players and I've got 3 positions and I'm just going to rotate continually and keep them fresh and we'll see how it goes. And then he ends up playing slightly stronger side in the Europa League, which obviously, as you get towards the knockout stages, is something that will be relatively important. It's a competition that Arsenal really should try and win now. So perhaps having one of those 4 play in the Europa League isn't that bad a thing. I don't know. It's exciting. It's very much unknown. No one really knows what Wenger wants to do, but it will be interesting to see how he handles it, won't it?
I mean, if Pep can get away with having Gabriel and Sergio Aguero, we can get away with having Lacazette and Aubameyang and keeping them both happy.
Yes. You would hope so.
Yeah.
You would hope
true.
So.
True. It's always a hypothetical.
Yes, but this is Arsenal. This is Wenger. And they have special ways of screwing things up. Let's talk shift gears a little bit. Looks like Malcolm isn't going to sign for Arsenal. Potentially may sign for Spurs. Certainly when the links were strongest to Arsenal, there was always the undercurrent of the Arsenal v Spurs North London battle for him. Would you be worried if he signed with Pochettino?
Yeah, it's just disappointing because it has nothing to do with necessity. We don't, if we get Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, obviously we don't need Malcolm. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with identifying a talent that clearly we were quite high on, and then just saying, well, since we don't need him, we won't sign him. But I don't get why you couldn't buy him, loan him back to Bordeaux, and then pick him up in the summer whenever you've got a much better idea of who's here for the long haul and who you can part ways with. And now, I mean, we always joke about it, but now you run the risk of 5 years down the road, Malcolm's tearing it up, and Arsene Wenger comes to the podium and says, I almost signed him, as if that means something. I don't know. It's a bummer. Obviously, nothing's happened yet. I think they said that he's going to finish the season at Bordeaux. But, I mean, they spoke with him the other day, and he was very open about how England is a dream for him. You know, if it came and if he were to leave, then great, he would leave. And it's like, it couldn't be any more transparent what he wants. And it's just a shame that we can't give it to him, at least not now. I mean, we don't know what exactly is happening, but from the sounds of it, Arsenal is completely out. And since Arsenal are out, Spurs are back in. And it seems like we had him if we wanted him, and we just willingly didn't want him.
I think I do agree with that, but if Wenger or Mislintat or I don't know who it would be, but if they've said, do you know what, actually, we're not sure how good he is, we're not sure... if he's actually worth the 40 million quid or whatever the fee is. We'd rather have the ready-made product in Aubameyang, because it seems like Mkhitaryan was going to happen whether Malcolm came or not. It was always a question of, will it be Aubameyang or will it be Malcolm? And if they've chosen to go with Aubameyang, I don't necessarily bemoan that decision. While it would be disappointing to see Malcolm go to Spurs, especially if he did well, at the end of the day, the decision to not sign Malcolm will ultimately be determined by how good or bad Malcolm is. If he ends up signing for Spurs and does well, then Arsenal will certainly regret this decision. If he ends up signing for Spurs and he's like Soldado, then they won't be so worried. And I think there's an element of just trusting your gut, and both Wenger and the club have just got to say, well, actually, our gut tells us that this player isn't quite as good as the fee suggests, and we're going to trust our evaluation of him, and we're going to make a different decision because of it. We'll see if that's right or wrong.
I've come to terms with that. Obviously, it's a better idea to have Aubameyang now rather than Malcolm now. But to me, that isn't the crux of the issue. I feel like I can't imagine that Malcolm popped up on the radar like 2 weeks ago and they scouted him for a week and then said, well, actually, he's not good enough. I feel like he's been on the radar for some time. And to me, at least, again, obviously, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but to me, it felt like the problem was they couldn't get him right now. They would have to loan him back. And I feel like that's something that Arsene Wenger couldn't justify in his head. Why would we pay for someone and pay his wages if we don't get him? Because that just doesn't sound like something Arsene Wenger would ever do. I think the alternative was severely overpaying for him, which we obviously don't want to see, for him to avoid that loan. But again, I don't see why you couldn't pay, what was it, like £40 million, which...
I think so, which, yeah, I mean, something in that kind of range.
Yeah, it's a bit much. But I don't know. If you rate him that highly, which, again, I think they do. If they don't and they backed off, then just forget everything I'm saying. But it seemed like they were really high on him. He was the first guy they went to. And then, you know, to just back out from what I think is either having to pay too much or loan him back. I don't see why you didn't just do it and loan him back. Because then, you know, it's like you've got work to do in the summer, but some of that work's already done. You already have a guy coming in that could be a solution. But, yeah, I don't know. What do I know?
Do you think they backed out because they initially didn't think that Aubameyang would be available and then he became available?
I don't know why you wouldn't think Aubameyang is going to be available, because he's had disciplinary issues all year. I think he's had two team-induced suspensions for bad behavior, for doing things he wasn't supposed to be doing. And, you know, but Dortmund has not been hiding how displeased they are with him.
No.
So, and Sven Mislintat, I feel like, would still be a bit tuned into that. I mean, he's the guy that brought in Aubameyang. I don't see how they wouldn't think he'd be available. Maybe they thought it was unlikely, but I don't.
Yeah, no. I think that's probably true. Certainly, Mislintat has his fingerprints all over these moves from Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang. He was reportedly the guy who pushed for Mavropanos, who looked very good in the under-23 game that he played the other day. Yeah.
And the guy who pushed for Malcolm.
And he's also reportedly the guy who pushed for Malcolm as well. So certainly one thing that we can draw from a world that is very rarely balanced and secure is that Mislintat is beginning to show his influence on the club, and his decisions are being listened to and they're now being acted upon as well, which is good. I think it's a good thing for the future of Arsenal Football Club that Wenger is willing to work with somebody and willing to adapt to the changes and the developments of the format of the board and the club and how transfers are done now and in the future. Before we take one more break and look forward to the Carabao Cup semi-final against Chelsea, do you have any other notes or any other things to point out regarding Arsenal transfer window?
Yeah, Leon Goretzka is never going to happen. He declared for Bayern Munich, which is just lovely, seeing as how last summer all he could say was, I'm tired of the Bayern speculation. I'm not going to Bayern. I'm not going to Bayern. And then 6 months later, he goes to Bayern. Well, not yet. He's going in the summer, but disappointing. Not least of all from because of my fetish for Schalke, but because I really wanted, if he was going to leave, to come to Arsenal, and instead he's going to the evil empire of Germany. So that's off, but we will survive.
Yeah, it felt like it was a matter of time before he signed for Bayern. There were some reports, maybe in kind of October time, that got me quite excited that Arsenal actually might be interested in him. But really, it kind of, just all young, talented Germans end up at Bayern Munich. It's just,
yeah,
it's kind of the way. It doesn't matter if they're from Schalke or Dortmund or Mönchengladbach or Leverkusen or whatever. They just always end up at Bayern Munich. Eventually, it's just the natural progression for young German players, and Goretzka's another one, and I'm sure he will flourish there. It's sad because I would have liked to have seen him in an Arsenal shirt like yourself.
Yeah.
Right, I think that's it for our little review of the January transfer window so far. There are only, I think there's maybe 8 days left, 7 days left as we are recording this. So there's only, you know, a little bit over a week left. So Arsenal, I'm sure, on that transfer deadline day when they still haven't signed Mkhitaryan or Aubameyang, will be panicking at 10:59. And we will be sweating with them to see if they can actually sign somebody or not. So we will, after the break, look forward to Wednesday night's game, which, ironically, in the smallest competition of the season, is probably the biggest game of the year thus far, where Arsenal play Chelsea at the Emirates. We'll see you in just a moment. Hello and welcome back to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. This is part three, where we are going to look forward to Wednesday night's semi-final in the Carabao Cup against Chelsea. Arsenal host the Blues. I think it's a 7:45 kickoff at the Emirates. After a 0-0 draw at Stamford Bridge, really this is a game that Arsenal have a great chance of qualifying for the first final of the year, which will be played in mid-February. First and foremost, before we take a real deep dive into this game, do you think Arsenal will win?
Of course I do. Why wouldn't I? No, I mean, you're coming off a really good win against Palace, a big confidence booster, and I mean, we went to Stamford Bridge and did exactly what we had to do, so I don't know why we wouldn't have faith, and then to finish out the job.
Yeah. I think Arsenal have got a great chance. Really, The primary issue with this tie was the trip to Stamford Bridge. Arsenal's form at home has been excellent all year long. They've only really disappointed in a couple of games for the whole season. And as shown on Saturday, they were very good at the Emirates again. And there's no reason to think that they won't be good at home again against Chelsea. They played very well the last time they played Chelsea at home, which was just as 2018 started in that really good 2-2 draw. And I think they've got a great opportunity. Chelsea are a good team, and they will create chances, and they will cause problems, and if given space and time and the opportunities, they will be able to score goals, and they will always defend well. But Arsenal have got as good a chance as any, and really, that I think against a team like Chelsea, that's all you can do, isn't it? Is just give yourself an opportunity to go and win the game, and that's where Arsenal are. Whether they will take that opportunity or not remains to be seen. We spoke in the last part about how their bench is looking a little bit light, a little bit limited in its options. How do you think Wenger will set up on Wednesday? Do you think there will be many changes from Saturday's game?
I don't know why there would be, other than I wonder if he doesn't start Kolasinac instead of Monreal. I guess it depends on how serious Monreal's injury was. Of course, on the flip side, he might have taken out Monreal that early just to be safe and just to save him for Chelsea, which it's always, as you know very well, predicting who goes out there is really tough. I'd love to see Ramsey back out there again. We haven't gotten any updates on his illness and if he'll be fit for it. And then I would like to think that Mkhitaryan will be available, but it's just not looking good, seeing as how, unless he's training with the club now and we legitimately just don't have pictures of him in a kit to release. I think we stick with what we had, which, I mean, I say this also hesitantly, but that's not a bad thing. I mean, it worked so well. Mm-hmm. And as long as Ozil's out there, we're always going to have creative intuition. And as long as Wilshere's out there, which both of them should be out there, I think as much as I'd like to see maybe a few changes, there's no need to.
Yeah, I think the key fitness news between now and Wednesday night is Ramsey. If Ramsey's fit to play, I suspect we see the midfield trio that we've been going on about for seemingly years of Xhaka, Ramsey and Wilshere with El Nene dropped. And if Mkhitaryan can be completed and he's proven fit and ready, then maybe he comes in for a Wobi. Or maybe Welbeck comes back. I don't know the seriousness of his injury. Do you know?
I don't. It was just one of those phantom injuries that nobody really heard about until the game.
Yeah, it seemed a little bit odd. So maybe a Wobi plays, maybe Mkhitaryan plays, maybe Welbeck's ready to come back. I'm not sure. I think it's a bit of a much of a muchness really. There, I don't think there'll be that much difference between the players. I think Mkhitaryan's the best of the three, but he's a new signing and to expect him to come in, you know, like to take him to like a duck to water is a little bit unrealistic, really.
It worked for Everton and Walcott.
He did well, yeah, I guess so. Did he actually play well? I've not really. I know he got an assist.
Assist. I didn't see if he played well or not.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, you never know. Theo Walcott is a truly world class player, as we have reiterated many times on this. On this podcast. Man, he's doing not even an Arsenal player anymore and we're still slagging him off.
I know, isn't it terrible? Like,
yeah. I did like Theo. He was a faithful, diligent servant. I think the key fitness concern to be kind of rectified or answered is Ramsey, and that will have quite a lot of ramifications on the rest of the team. One thing that I'll be interested to see will be whether he drops Bellerin. Bellerin is the only outfield player to have played every single minute of the Premier League for Arsenal so far. He's played a lot of football. I wonder if he starts Debuchy or even Chambers or even Maitland-Niles at right back. Maybe not something that I would do, but it might be something that Wenger has in mind. One thing that is slightly beneficial is that Arsenal don't have a game next weekend because it's the FA Cup and they are sadly out of the FA Cup. So they actually have a week off between Chelsea, or I think it's 6 days off between Chelsea, and then I think it's Swansea the midweek after. Mm-hmm. So in terms of playing a lot of games, actually, whereas Chelsea have got an FA Cup tie at the weekend, Arsenal don't. So Wenger can be a little less distracted by the regularities of the football season, which is certainly going to play into his hands. It doesn't mean he doesn't necessarily have to rotate as much as Conte might have to. Do you think that Chelsea will be able to cause Arsenal problems as they have done in the past, especially in the 2-2 draw, or do you think that Arsenal will be able to handle them in a back four or a back three?
I don't know how many times I can say this before it really bites me in the ass, but Chelsea has not worried me lately, and I just... I think it's like the last three or four performances, I haven't felt like they were above us in any way. I felt like we were every bit their equal, if not their superior. Obviously, they're going to cause us problems. Any team with any sort of quality is going to have moments where they really, you know, get into our weaknesses. But and of course, the added stakes of they didn't do what they had to do at Stamford Bridge, so now they have to come here and do something, come to the Emirates to do something. It's going to have, you know, a bit of added motivation, which for a team with their quality is always troubling, but I have every bit of confidence in the world that whatever they can muster, we can put down, assuming that we have the same quality of players that we did against Crystal Palace, which, as we talked about, I don't see why we wouldn't.
I mean, one thing to note is that Morata and Pedro will be available for selection after that they were suspended at the weekend, so it'd be surprised if surprising if Batshuayi plays up front. Pete Crouch may play, we never know. In theory, it will be Morata, and while Morata's come in for a lot of stick recently because he's missing a lot of chances, which to some extent is fair enough, but I think he's a lot better player than people are perhaps giving him credit for. While he's missing these chances, his movement is still pretty good. He's very intelligent, especially that kind of peel to the back post where he uses his height from crossing situations. He's really dangerous and has caused Arsenal problems in the past. He's nearly scored in the 0-0 draw right at the start of the year when he peeled onto, I think it was Mustafi, I think at the far post, and Azpilicueta tried to find him from across. So Morata, while perhaps a bit of a wayward, wasteful finisher, he has the ability to create chances for himself through his movement, through his anticipation, through his positioning. And there are, I guess, vulnerabilities in Mustafi and Koscielny where they can be a bit overly aggressive in trying to nick the ball in front of a striker, or they can be slightly caught out of position because they want to press a bit higher up the pitch and Morata may be able to slip their attentions. I don't think Arsenal can rely on him to miss the same amount and quality of chances as he did last time out, that is for certain.
I do think that Mustafi kind of lives in Morata's head, though. I mean, every time they match up, it's a matter of Mustafi being very physical with him and Morata constantly on the ground, looking at the ref, looking for help. And I do think that takes a toll on you after a while. It's that some defenders you don't want to see. And when you do, maybe it puts you in a different state of confidence than if you're facing Rob Holding or Callum Chambers or something. Yeah, I mean, you're right. A lot of the problems that Morata's having are similar to what Lacazette was having. Obviously, Lacazette's a better finisher, but Morata does bring a lot of the consistent play that he's been bringing all year is still there. Just like same with Lacazette, it's just he's in a gold slump of his own that isn't going to last forever. Just hopefully it lasts through one more week.
Yes, yes, and Arsenal play Chelsea a lot. This is the fourth game that they've played Chelsea. Three of those games have come in January, so in the space of, it'd be about 21 days, I think, between the three games. So these are two teams that know each other very, very well. If you're not especially scared of anybody, do you think that Eden Hazard is probably the primary threat for Conte's team?
I don't know if I've pointed this out before, and this might make me sound really stupid, but Hazard is one guy who I have always thought is overrated. And I'm not just saying that because I don't like him. Obviously, I don't like him. He's a Chelsea player. But I've never understood why people rated him over Sanchez. Why? I don't know. That's besides the point. He obviously is a threat. You know, when he's on his game, he can do some amazing things. He does strike me as a big threat, but to me, the bigger threat is how they use speedy players like Willian or Victor Moses. I think that's one area you can still really plague Arsenal with. And I think their wingbacks worry me too, with Moses and Marcus Alonso.
Yeah.
Because they always seem to find a lot of space. And if we do go with the four at the back, I mean, we're all very high on Monreal. He had a fantastic game, but he doesn't have the speed to keep up with if they really press that side of the pitch. I do think he can get overwhelmed. So the width is what worries me the most, how we're able to cope with that, because I think, apart from not having a lot of width ourselves lately, I don't think we defend it particularly well. Bellerin's defending has not been where it needs to be lately, especially, I mean, there is even a play against Palace where he was sucked way too far central and they had so much room on his side, and it's just, that's the kind of thing that a team like Chelsea will eat. They'll eat you alive if you give them that kind of room on the edge. And if they're sending consistent balls into the box, eventually Morata's going to put one away. You can't keep relying on him to screw up.
Yeah, this is the type of game where I'd actually like to see Arsenal max Chelsea up, and actually I would like to see them play a back three and really press really high up the pitch, and instead of the two wide players in the front three tracking back on the wing backs, I'd rather see them press right up onto the wide centre halves of Chelsea. So say it's, I don't know, Iwobi, Ozil and Lacazette. You say, right, we're going to press onto Cahill, Christensen and Azpilicueta, and we're going to play really high up the pitch. We're going to play man for man across the whole pitch. And then you leave the two wing backs, Moses up against, say, Kolasinac or Maitland-Niles, and then Bellerin up against Alonso. And you just leave them on a little bit of an island, and you hope that they can at least hold their own against Chelsea's wing-backs. Because I think if Arsenal can do that, I think in the midfield they can dominate, because even if they play Fabregas with Kante, I really don't think Bakayoko's a very good player. I think Arsenal can really exploit him. I think a Xhaka and Wilshere or Xhaka and Ramsey midfield partnership, I think if they play high up the pitch, they can cause Kante to misplace passes, which he does do every now and then. They can get in behind Bakayoko, and they can really suffocate the game by playing really high up the pitch and playing on the front foot. Personally, that's what I would like to see them do. Whether that's what will actually happen, whether that's what Wenger will do. The reason why the back three has become so prevalent in recent months is because it does so well against a back four, because you can you can both exploit wide by having these two inside forwards who don't actually have any defensive responsibility, and they can stay high up the pitch, so you can play on the counter, but you don't necessarily sacrifice your central midfield, because they're allowed to drift inside and play at times as a central midfielder. The back three, especially Chelsea's version of the back three, works wonderfully against the back four. If you max them up man for man, sometimes you're just a better team. And I think that's what I personally would like to see Arsenal do. I'd like to just see them max them up.
If they do go with the back four, I would hope that they would start Kolasinac on the left side and not Monreal, because at least he has the athleticism to cope with, or at least to better cope with, what's going on over there. Plus, one thing I will always admire about Kolasinac, if he does get beat, he will take the guy down that beat him and not allow him to get a free run, which eventually is going to start turning into yellow cards. But for now, it's not. So
he's not afraid of just kicking them, is he?
which is great. And I'd rather see that than see Monreal send in a cross that gets cleared right out to Victor Moses, and then it's off to the races, and we all know who's going to win that race.
Mm. Yes. And I think Monreal, while he's extremely experienced and positionally he's very good, as a left-back there is more room for him to be, for his lack of mobility, his lack of pace, to be exploited. And we have seen that in the past, where he struggled with not necessarily good wingers, but just quick. Just wingers with pace who know how to use it, they have caused him problems in the past. Let's shift tack slightly as we come to a close here. Would you be happy if Arsenal won the Carabao Cup but failed to get into the top four or win the Europa League this season?
No, the goal has to be getting into the Champions League. Again, this is speculation, but I can't imagine Lacazette giving up 2 years of Champions League. One, fine, you know, if you tell him we're going to get back in it, but then you have to get back in it. And I can't imagine Aubameyang or Mkhitaryan or even Ozil being too happy with another year without Champions League football. That's what they're all here to do. So, no, not making the Champions League would be a catastrophe. That should be the number one.
Would you rather get in the top four then and not win a trophy?
Yes.
You
but,
sure?
I mean...
You hesitated a tad.
I'm not 100% sure. I'd rather win the Europa League and say finish fifth or sixth than finish fourth and not win a trophy.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Because I do think silverware and the Champions League you got to have both of them. I think if you had to choose between silverware or getting into the Champions League, it's got to be Champions League. I hate that I have to say we're playing for the top four again, but that you can only make the most of what you have, and that's the most we can do right now.
Yeah, I agree. The more I think about it, the more I think that the Europa League should become the real priority of this season, because it's silverware and it's Champions League all rolled into one. And actually, Arsenal have got a really nice tie. There are some nice ties elsewhere where good teams will be knocked out because there have been two good teams drawn against one another. It's a very winnable competition, and you bring in somebody like Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, and okay, you can only play one of them because of the stipulations of playing players who've already played in the Champions League, but actually Arsenal have the squad and the team to be able to go and win that competition. They won their group at a relative canter, and Mesut Ozil never played a minute, and Granit Xhaka hardly played, and Jack Walsh is playing far better now, and Ramsey never played, so a lot of these players never played. I think if you commit your resources to the Europa League, it's a very, very winnable competition for Arsenal. So personally, I'd like to see that be the priority this season.
It's a bit dicier, though. I mean, you're putting all your eggs into a basket where it's going to get to the point where a single loss and you don't get it. So
yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, I'd like to see them obviously focus on it, but I do think that finding a way into the top four should still weigh pretty heavily on their minds, and I think with Arsene Wenger it always will. I mean, he's always going to prioritize the Premier League over capturing his first European trophy. I don't think that he's that kind of manager that's gonna put his own needs in front of that of the team. But
no, I think you can. I don't mean just abandon the league for the Europa League, but I think you can play both for now. But as the season goes on, I wonder if it would become more astute to begin to commit more resources to the Europa League rather than the league, especially if Arsenal lose more ground on Liverpool and Chelsea and Spurs in the race for the top four. Liverpool play Swansea on Monday night. We're recording this in the afternoon, so the game hasn't happened yet. But if Liverpool go and win that game, Arsenal will be 8 points off the top four, which at this point in the season is actually quite a substantial gap. So whether they can haul themselves back into it, you know, an 8 point deficit is a big one, and they've got a lot of work to do in the league. I think they may have a better chance of winning the Europa League than they do getting the top four in the league, but obviously that's still to come. To close then, have you got a score prediction for us?
I'll go with 2-1. I think it'll be a very similar to the FA Cup final where we come out really guns blazing and we get a goal, maybe even two early on, but Chelsea's going to have too much pride to let it sit at that, and I don't think we have the defensive capabilities to stop them from imposing a bit of their own will on the game.
Yeah, I have a feeling that Arsenal are going to win as well. I very much look at it like the FA Cup run last year where they beat City and then beat Chelsea in the semi-final and final. I think Wenger's got very good at winning cup competitions, especially late. He doesn't lose many semi-finals or finals. Arsenal either lose early in the competition where they've played a weakened team and they've perhaps underestimated opposition, or they go very far and potentially even win the competition. I think here they've got a very, very good chance of winning the Carabao Cup, and I think Wenger recognises that. And I think he's going to get his players really ready to play. I think they really want to prove themselves with Alexis Sanchez now essentially gone. With or without Mkhitaryan, I think they'll really look to play on the front foot and play well. So I'll match your score prediction of 2-1.
Very nice.
Mm. So we're both being tentatively optimistic, I would probably describe it.
I would call it realistic. I don't think it's optimistic at all to think that we can scratch a one goal win at home in a semifinal, which, as you said, has been a forte of this team lately. So I'm going to deny that it's even optimism.
Right. Wow. I think that probably sums everything up, that you see that as realistic, and I see that as optimistic.
I'm so optimistic that I'm going to say it's not even optimistic.
Yes, that is the hopeful perspective of this podcast. It doesn't come through that often, but every now and then we can be hopeful, can't we? Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, hopefully next time we talk, we will have two new players, and hopefully those two new players are the two players we've been talking about, because...
Yes, it would be somewhat waste of time if neither now joined after having done an hour and a half's podcasting on how they might fit into the Arsenal team.
Like, wasting listeners' time is bad enough, but wasting each other's time, that's even worse.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Alexis Sanchez back at the Emirates in another sulk.
No, that's not funny. Come on.
So, thank you very much for listening. This has been the Pain in the Arsenal podcast, episode 14. Please find us on Twitter and on Facebook. Just search for Pain in the Arsenal. You can find both me and Josh. We're writing regularly on paininthearsenal.com as well. Any comments, any feedback, any questions, get in contact with us. We always love to hear from our listeners, and we always love to discuss all the good, the bad and the ugly of Arsenal Football Club with everybody. We don't just want to be talking to each other. So thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week sometime, I assume. As Josh said, with two new players in the Carabao Cup final, with Arsenal on the up, obviously. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.